evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are looking at today, Wednesday, April 15, 2015. A known gunman attacks Sudanese traders in northern Bahr al-Ghazal state.
We are not happy if our neighbors mistreat the citizen like that, because since independence, we don't have such cases between us here.
And the United Nations helps South Sudan government to go digital.
National Archive is very important. It's the house for all the information of South Sudan, and it's the house of all the evidence, historical evidence.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. At least 9 passengers traveling on a commercial truck from Sudan to northern Bahr al-Ghazal state say they were robbed at gunpoint at the Sudanese border near Miram. Abraham Agod reports for VOA from Awil, 6 Sudanese businessmen were among the traders taking goods to South Sudan where commodities are scarce.
One of the 3 South Sudanese passengers who was robbed says they were beaten up while the 6 Sudanese businessmen were detained. Rafael describes what happened in Arabic.
We saw people landing down from the camels with guns. We were told to come out of the vehicle and they began removing everything we had. Thereafter, they began beating us. We told them we are South Sudanese and they said, go down on foot. We told them not to harm the other Sudanese colleagues we left behind. Then we moved a few kilometers and saw them ordering these businessmen to move with them.
Rafael says he doesn't know what happened to the Sudanese businessmen. Northern Bahr al-Ghazal state lawmaker Santino Mayuat, who met with the 3 released passengers, confirms the incident took place. He says that the 3 are being taken care of, but were in bad shape when they arrived in Mejognintiu.
Because of the hunger and the working on foot, coming from right away from Merim to Mejognintiu. From Mejognintiu has been taken by the Cho soldiers. They came here yesterday, there were 3. 2 of them, they went to Nyomlel, and this William is the one of Western Equatoria.
Mayuat Ngong blames the Sudanese government for failing to provide adequate road security along the border with South Sudan. And he is urging Khartoum to track down on the perpetrators.
We are not happy if our neighbors used to mistreat the citizen like that, because since independence, we don't have such cases between us here. We don't have cases of robbing our country, I mean the Sudan citizen. They are here in Awil physically. They are our brothers. But when our people, our sovereign came from north, I don't know what happened to those Americans. We used to make this peace. They accept it, but later on it can be violated.
Many Sudanese businessmen and truck drivers continue to illegally smuggle goods between Sudan and South Sudan because of commercial roadblocks along Sudan's border, despite complaining about the risk involved with the cross-border trading. Some say the 3 passengers are lucky. Others have been killed for refusing to turn over their goods to robbers. For VOA News, I'm Abraham Igot reporting in Awil.
Classes are back in session at Kwajok National Secondary School in Warrap State, but not all students who walked out last week are back at their desks, as Santino Monut reports from Kwajok.
It is time for class at Kwajok National Secondary School, but not everyone is rushing into the class. Instead, students are milling around and talking about the demand that made them boycott classes last week. The students say they want to be able to follow the curriculum from Sudan, which allows students to finish their secondary school studies a year earlier than the South Sudanese curriculum. The students say the authorities in Warrap State are imposing the South Sudan curriculum on them. They say that in neighboring states, students follow the curriculum from Sudan. Some of the students in Kwajok also say Sudan's curriculum is better than South Sudan's. Deng Anai is representing the students who are unhappy with South Sudanese curriculum. He says that in truth, South Sudan does not even have its own syllabus.
They just go and bring Uganda syllabus and say that these are South Sudanese syllabus. Are we Uganda? We are South Sudanese. And if we are South Sudanese, we must have our curriculum.
Warab State Minister for Education, Victor Atem Atem, says ringleaders of the strike are soldiers.
Among them here, and the rest of our school here in Warab State, and the rest of the school in South Sudan, there are soldiers among them. And we accepted everybody, whoever ready to go back to school.
He says some of the soldiers are tired of studying and want to finish school quickly so that they can go back to their barracks and seek promotion. He says this is not the first time that soldiers have caused trouble in the school.
You remember last year, chaos, what happened last year? Behind them were some soldiers that in this school that were trying to be in a hurry. Say that they complete and they go back to the barracks.
South Sudan is phasing out the syllabus and curriculum from Sudan. The latest batch of candidates will sit the Sudan school certificate exams at the end of this month. None of them are in Warab State, where Education Minister Atem says there are no plans to meet the demands of striking students and switch back to Sudanese curriculum for one last time. For BOA News, I am Santino Manut Ayuel in Kwajok.
Prices for basic commodities are skyrocketing all over South Sudan, and Western Bahr al-Ghazal is no exception. The high price of sugar is causing many to forego their daily ritual of taking tea in a country where many people drink as many as 4 cups in one sitting. Dimo Silva has more for VOA from WOW.
At the University of Bahr al-Ghazal, several women set up portable tables beneath mango trees to sell tea and bread. But the last 2 weeks, they have seen their profits fall because fewer and fewer customers are coming to the tables. Due to rising sugar prices, tea makers upped the cost of a cup of tea from 1,000 Sudanese pounds to 2. Those who prefer to drink coffee with milk are now paying 3,000 Sudanese pounds. Akech Philip, a fourth-year business administration student, used to drink at least 4 cups of tea each day. Now, he only drinks 2 cups.
If I buy 4 cups, now presently I will be wasting 8 pounds, in which each cup costs 2 pounds. So I'm not limiting myself to 2 cups so that I waste 4 pounds in a day.
Tea makers say they will not make a profit if the price of a cup of tea stays the same. They say a kilogram of sugar used to cost them 6 pounds, but is now 10 pounds. 34-year-old Yolelia Agustino makes tea at the University of Bahr al-Ghazal campus. She says while some of her customers understand the price increase, others complain a lot.
We used to get dry tea at 2 South Sudanese pounds, but now it is 3. And if we make tea at 1 pound, we will not get any gain. That is why we have to sell tea at 2 pounds, and we are also going to increase the price for big cups of tea. You cannot expect us to stay the whole day making tea at 1 South Sudanese pound, yet prices in the market are high. Even charcoal has become expensive.
The higher cost of tea and sugar has got many South Sudanese sinking. They may have to give up their beloved daily ritual. 55-year-old housewife Helena Idris says she has decided to forgo tea and concentrate on buying basic food items instead.
If you hold 5 to 10 pounds in your hands and you go with it to the market, you will get that sugar is at 10, 9, or even 12 in the residential areas. That means we have to avoid tea since there's no other option. Our market is bad.
Traders insist the rise in price was mainly caused by the government's decision to close various border points between South Sudan and Sudan, as well as the U.S. dollar exchange rate increase. State and national lawmakers have said the solution is to grow food locally rather than buying it from other countries. But insecurity and bad roads have made that all but impossible for many South Sudanese. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio reporting in WOW.
We now turn to Nairobi, where the Kenyan government has issued a 10-day amnesty to all young people who have joined the Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab. The move comes as investigators reveal that some of the attackers at Garissa University were Kenyan youth trained in Somalia. Muhammad Yusuf has the story for VOA from Nairobi.
As Kenya tries to come to terms with the terror event that took place 2 weeks ago at Garissa University College, where more than 140 people were killed, Kenyan officials have issued amnesty to youths who have joined Al-Shabaab and are willing to denounce violence. Interior Ministry spokesman Mwenda Njoka tells VOA his government has come up with a program that targets youths willing to reintegrate into society.
We didn't have a systematic program of rehabilitating, and others would come. We know they are here, but they fear being coming out in the open for fear of prosecution. So what we are trying to do is to encourage them to come out. We work with them and see how they can get them back as useful members of society.
The country was shocked when investigators revealed some of the attackers were Kenyan youths who joined Al-Shabaab some years ago. One of them was the son of a local chief in one of the Mandera County towns was hit by terror attacks in the past 4 months. Kenya also offered amnesty to radical youths in 2012. Months after Kenyans sent troops to Somalia in October 2011, the government reported dozens surrendered and have been helping authorities with information about the presence of the militant group in Somalia and Kenya. The United Nations Monitoring Group for Somalia and Eritrea estimates more than 500 Kenyans have joined Al-Shabaab. Njoka knows rehabilitation centres will be created to provide help for them.
Some of them have gone through very traumatising processes in the process of being radicalised. So what you'd want to do is to do something to reverse that process so that they are engaged today. We work with them. If they are, those ones are looking for jobs, we see how we can be able to help them. Others who may be able to join colleges, we see how we can assist them.
Kenyan authorities insist they're serious with the offer. The amnesty ends April 24th. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The UN helps South Sudan preserve important document records. That story is coming up.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what can the governments do to help keep food prices reasonable?
Well, the government has been trying to regulate, but while the government also looks at implementing long-term measures to boost agricultural productivity, I think they just have to continue subsidizing in order to let the farmers have the input at affordable levels.
I don't have the seeds. I don't have the pesticides to help me in my crops. It can't promote, but if the government help me as a farmer with the pesticides, seeds, irrigate my plants, I think as a country we can be developed in terms of agriculture.
And the government also needs to empower the citizen to give them agricultural tools, the seeds, the tractors, so that we'll have food.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The United Nations is helping South Sudan to preserve government records and other important documents and make them more accessible to future generations. The UN cultural organization, UNESCO, this week began running training sessions on how to digitize documents and access free online educational materials. Charlton Doki reports for VOA from Juba.
More than a dozen young South Sudanese are taking part in the one-week training session run by UNESCO. They will learn how to digitalize information and access educational and other material online. The training is aimed at preserving documents like the government records that date from the colonial era and have been through two civil wars and many other conflicts and crises. Many of the records were gathered together in the 1970s and early 1980s, following the end of the first civil war between Southern Sudan and the Khartoum government, and were kept in Juba. The head of the Information, Communication and Culture Committee in South Sudan's parliament, Thomas Wanikundu, says many of the documents that had been painstakingly collected and brought to Juba for safekeeping were scattered and sometimes destroyed. Those that remained in Juba were stored in sacks and dirty file cabinets. Over the years, they have been damaged by water or eaten by termites. Kundu says that digitalizing the historic documents and putting them online will help preserve the documents and make it easy for anyone in the world to access information about South Sudan.
Do not be surprised one day that some people may come from America or from Australia to come and get information from this center. So this center is like a bank. You are keeping valuable information like somebody keeping money in the bank. Therefore, this training is vital for you.
Yusuf Onyala is the Director General of South Sudan's National Archives. But he says efforts to digitalize the material have up to now been hampered by the lack of trained personnel.
Today is a very, very important day to have this training. National Archive is very important. It's the house for all the information of South Sudan. And it's a house of all the evidence, historical evidence, so that it needs such training to have a staff who are competent to preserve all our information.
Rose Njoroge is one of the trainers. A lecturer at Nairobi-based Kenyatta University, Njoroge says digitalizing South Sudan's National Archives will expand the number of people who have access to information about the country.
The moment the materials are in manual form, printed form, these are like books, the text, the analog audio and videos, then you realize you are limited to the number of people that can access. And in most cases, the materials are just housed in a room. But the moment you digitize or convert the resources from that analog or manual format to a digital format, then you allow the materials to be stored, preserved, and distributed through the internet or ICT, and be able to share with the rest of the world the culture, the history, and the heritage that South Sudan has. And that way we are also opening ourselves to the rest of the world, because we are seeing South Sudan need to grow, and it need to grow very fast. And how do we grow if we don't tell the people what we already have?
In addition to learning how to convert the documents into digital form, the trainees at the workshop will learn how to access open education resources, including online journals and books, Njoroge says. UNESCO has provided digitization hardware and software for the week-long training session. UNESCO's representative in South Sudan, Salah Khalid, says the UN agency places a great deal of importance on access to information.
The development of any nation that is measured by how much information is shared among its population. It's like a treasure. The more you share it, the more you develop the people around you. And this is why in UNESCO we give it a lot of importance, the preservation of this treasure. It's part of your history. Information becomes your history. It becomes your heritage. It represents the values of the people of South Sudan.
Njoroge says that when it comes to accessing information, South Sudan has a lot of catching up to do.
There are people who are already ahead of us, and we need to catch up very fast. And since there are institutions like what we call the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which has what we call massive open online courses, MOOCs, whereby they have already put online the courses that that institute offers, which is open. Anybody in the world can get to the courses, learn what the university offers without paying a cent. And therefore, University of Juba can benefit from those resources.
The government of the Netherlands is funding the week-long training. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
A new report says many countries are failing to improve economic growth and living standards because of what is called digital poverty. The World Economic Forum has released its Global Information Technology Report for 2015. It says the full economic and social benefits of the Internet are only available to a minority of the world's population. It adds that many countries are failing to implement basic reforms that could increase productivity and boost their economies. Cherry Gaigo is a senior economist for the World Economic Forum and a co-editor of the report. From London, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
So digital poverty is the inability to use IT either due to the lack of access or due to the lack of skills. It is really a form of poverty because without digital access, without digital skills, you cannot tap into the huge potential of technology to improve your lives and create opportunities.
Is this a new way to measure the world's economy?
It's not a new way, but we believe that technology has become a key enabler of development, and this should be taken seriously. It's not just a luxury or something you do after having addressed other supposedly more pressing issues. Technology can really, really accelerate development in low-income economies and more advanced economies, and we believe that this should be taken really seriously. And the truth is that everybody believes that technology is everywhere, but it is not, and we're missing out on huge opportunities.
Now, the report says Singapore is at the top of the list when it comes to leveraging its technology for social and economic impact. Can you explain how Singapore has done that?
Yes, so in our study, we look at the many drivers of this capacity to leverage IT for competitiveness and for well-being in general. And in the case of Singapore, those drivers all point in the right direction. So we're looking at education, we're looking at the digital ecosystem, you know, the framework conditions for innovation to flourish. We looked at the actual usage, we look at how the government is using technology to enable e-government and e-citizenship. And the entire economy is geared towards knowledge and information and innovation-driven. That makes Singapore really like the top of its class.
What are some of the other top countries?
In the top 10, you know, 7 European countries, mostly the Nordics, so Finland, Sweden, Norway, rank very high. We also observe the rise of the Baltics. So the smaller countries like Estonia and Lithuania and Latvia are also very strong at building a digital economy. Switzerland is also strong, the U.S. in number 7, and Japan number 10. So European and 3 other advanced economies in the top 10. And more generally, we observe a very strong correlation between income level and performance index.
So who's at the bottom?
So we continue to see low-income countries at the bottom of the ranking. We have 143 economies. The bottom of the ranking is occupied by mostly low-income economies, mostly from sub-Saharan Africa. We do observe some success stories amid the bleak picture in these regions. You have countries like Mauritius, you have countries like Rwanda, you have smaller countries in Latin America, for example, Costa Rica or Panama, doing quite well in our ranking, so punching above their weight when it comes to building digital economy.
So does the report make any recommendations as to what countries should be doing in the future?
The report highlights a number of solutions and recommendations on how to address this digital poverty and really bring the IT revolution to the whole world. It's a mix of private sector actions and government interventions. The government has a huge role to play in creating enabling conditions for the private sector to enter the market and offer services and deploy the infrastructure. They have a huge role to play, the government, again, to build the skill set of the population. So it's a combination of factors. There is no one-size-fits-all solution, but the report highlights a number of solutions for all the countries, not just the low-income countries.
Now, I understand this digital divide is not only between countries, but can happen within a country itself.
Even in the most advanced economies, we do observe a widening gap between those who have access to technology and have the skills to use it to the full potential and the others who, because of their age or because of their location or because of their lack of education or simply lack of money to pay for IT, cannot take full benefit of ICT. And this widening digital divide within countries is also a concern that should be addressed, because if it is addressed, then you can really use ICT to create more inclusive societies and support inclusive growth.
Thierry Geygo is a senior economist for the World Economic Forum. From London, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. International rights agencies say 2015 is shaping up to be the deadliest year for immigrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea. In the latest tragedy, the human rights group Save the Children reports an estimated 400 people, many of them children, lost their lives in recent days while making the dangerous crossing from Libya to Italy. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The month of April is only half over, and yet it has been extraordinary in terms of the number of people rescued at sea. Official figures indicate the Italian Coast Guard has picked up more than 7,000 migrants between April 10th and 13th. Save the Children says some 450 of them are children, 317 unaccompanied by an adult. Joel Millman, a spokesman for the International Organization for Migration, says so far about 8,000 people have been rescued in April. These numbers, he says, indicate the 2015 migrant smuggling season is in full swing.
We're on pace to be well ahead of last year's totals for all migrant arrivals from Africa into Italy. We're on pace to be five times the rate of fatalities. Past weekend, we passed 500 deaths on the Mediterranean of migrants leaving Africa. This time last year, there were 47, although by the end of April 2014, that had grown to 96. So we're at least five times the first 4 months of 2014's rate.
Millman says the tide of migration from Libya toward Italy is growing at a far more alarming and more deadly rate this year than last. He says many more migrants are fleeing Libya and making the precarious journey across the sea to escape the violent and crime-ridden conditions in that country.
A lot of what we see are people who are part of the traditional workforce that come up through West Africa to work in Libya, but because it's difficult to remit money home and because there's just so much common crime in the streets of cities like Tripoli right now, they're afraid that they can't keep their money, they can't stay safe, so they're seeking a way to get out on these ships.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees says at least 3,500 people drowned while attempting to cross the Mediterranean from North Africa in 2014. International humanitarian agencies predict that record number of deaths will be surpassed this year. They are calling on the European Union to step up action to stop this intolerable loss of life. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani says Iran is in talks to reach a final nuclear agreement with six world powers, not with U.S. lawmakers. Mr. Rouhani's remarks today were an apparent reaction to developments Tuesday in Washington, where President Barack Obama pledged to sign a bill that would subject the deal to U.S. congressional review. A U.S. drone strike killed a top cleric from the al-Qaeda branch in Yemen, the group announced yesterday. Ibrahim al-Rubaish, a Saudi national, joined al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula after being freed from the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay. And finally, local officials and residents say Islamic State fighters captured more land outside the capital of Iraq's Anbar province today. In an offensive that began at dawn, the militants seized Abu Ghanim, located a few kilometers east of Ramadi. And that's a look at today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Dodo by a traditional Lokoya group from eastern Equatorial State. We have been listening to a traditional Lokoya group from eastern Equatorial State with the song Dodo. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Yeah.